one of the darkest and most dangerous and least explored jungles of the world, the heart of darkness in Ecuador, which is where my next guest, Lee Elders, traveled several times in search of fame and fortune and truth. He went looking for gold, then later looking for emeralds, and found a lot more. It's an incredible story told in his new book, Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire. Amazingly, Lee has never been on Coast to Coast before, so we look forward to having his first interview on this program, and we'll get right to it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Lee Elders was destined to be an investigator adventurer. He was born in a railroad house in Bowie, Arizona, and later raised on the Apache Reservation near San Carlos, where his pet was a coyote and his mentor, an Apache medicine man, who helped to forge his resolve during his expeditions, much later expeditions, to Ecuador. He has an extensive background as an investigator, including a company called Intercept that specializes in computer security and electronic countermeasures. He's an author and documentary filmmaker, and he and his wife, Britt, have traveled the world exploring the unknown. They were among the first investigators of the Billy Meyer UFO case, which is how I first met him. I guess it's close to 25 years ago now. Lee Elders, amazingly, has never been on Coast to Coast before, but Lee, I want to welcome you to the program.
Hey, George, been a long time.
Is it possible that it's 25 years? My gosh.
I hope not, but I think you're right, yeah.
And we're both younger than we were before, yeah.
Absolutely.
I really enjoyed the book, Expeditions, Gold, Shaman, and Green Fire. And normally I would not dwell on somebody, I guess, childhood, but in this case, I think I want to start there because it's pretty clear that your appreciation for indigenous people and your understanding of their ways had a lot to do with you surviving the expeditions to Ecuador. So tell me about growing up on San Carlos, what it was like for you.
Oh, yeah. I was raised by my grandparents. My grandfather was a section foreman on the Southern Pacific Railroad, and we always lived in out-of-the-way places. And San Carlos was one where I grew up, and we were out in the middle of nowhere. A lot of dry washes around the house. I used to explore them when I was 9 or 10. Had my Red Ryder BB gun with me and my pup, the coyote, that my grandfather found one day along the railroad tracks. He had been separated from his pack and brought him home, and I raised him, and we became inseparable during those years.
That would be a pretty amazing story by itself, but it is kind of central to you surviving your time in on the reservation, because I guess you describe, you don't go into a lot of detail, but you say you had a pretty tough time of it. I can't imagine there are a whole lot of Anglo kids running around there.
Oh, I was the only white eyes. I felt like General Custer. I was blonde, outnumbered, outgunned, and I lost most of the rock fights with the young Apache bucks. But I made friends with them too, and we lived together in harmony later on, and I went to San Carlos School. It was a one-room schoolhouse, and I went through several grades there before I finally left the Apache Reservation and went to Tempe, Arizona, and lived with my mother there for a while. Went through high school, a couple of years, 3 years of college. But the Apache Reservation is very dear to my heart because a lot of poverty there, saw how the kids lived, and the indigenous people became, well, they became like part of my family, and that really helped me later on in Ecuador.
Just not to dwell on it too much, but getting a coyote and having it as your pet, it made a difference, didn't it, in your interactions with the other young people?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, I found out later that after the pup grew up and he had a pretty good snarl with him, and all of a sudden the Apache kids left me alone. And one day I was climbing this mountain, a small hill close to the house, and that's when I ran into this old Indian man, Apache man. Later I found out he was a medicine man, and he and I became friends. He taught me the ways of the Apache. He taught me how to hunt game, make bows and arrows, those type of things. And one day he says, how's your spirit dog doing? And I asked him to clarify it, and he said, well, he says, the coyote, to some Indian clans, is a prankster. But he said, I had a coyote, too, at one time, and he wasn't a prankster. He says, those kids will leave you alone now because that spirit dog will protect you. And he was right. When I went out with the dog, the kids, they didn't want to do rock fights with me. And so it worked out well.
Talk a little bit about the medicine man and the kind of, I guess, a sensitivity to the ways and the lore of indigenous peoples that you learned from him. I know a lot of it was probably specific to Apaches, but these were lessons that that served you well later on, right?
Oh, they really did, because he taught me to trust my heart and go with my heart. And he taught me, like I said, how to find water when no water was around, with barrel cactus and that sort of thing. He taught me how to make bows and arrows. But the most important thing was his message to me, and that is always follow your heart and always treat your brothers with respect, no matter who they are. And he was about 80 years old, I would guess, back then. And he told me, I asked him what his name was one day, and he says, call me the Apache Kid. And, gosh, I thought, wow, is this the real Apache Kid? Because everybody heard about this renegade Apache at one time that eventually was sentenced to prison in Yuma, Arizona. And after, I think, a couple months in prison down there, he broke free, got out of prison, and they never found him again. And the U.S. Cavalry, they looked for him, but they couldn't find him. So I had read and heard stories about this guy, and today I don't know if he was a real one or not, but I think at a tender age of 9 or 10, he was a real one for me at that time.
So, medicine man. So does that mean peyote, elixirs, things of that sort?
Oh, no, no. Mainly are herbs and plants and things of that nature. He showed me some plants. I can't remember their names now, but they used them for medicine, or he did. He treated people with them, and that was my first experience with that type of person. Later on, when I got to Ecuador and I met this shaman, he did exactly the same thing. He was a curer. So the Apache Kid was more or less a buddy. He really didn't get into too much medicine with me, but he did teach me the ways of the Apache.
Here in the Southwest, as you know, there are all kinds of treasure stories. Lost mine here, lost buried gold, all kinds of great tales, fanciful tales that are just real enough to be tantalizing and lead folks down a road, but they never seem to come true. So when I heard that you were writing, or when you had written a book about a treasure search, I thought, oh, this is going to be lead us down a path. He's going to look for it but never find it. But you learn early on in your book that you did find some treasure, and I want you to tell me. I love this stuff, by the way. I get gold fever just talking about it. What it was that hooked you, and how it is that you first ended up in Ecuador.
Okay, what hooked me was the freedom I had as a youngster and the adventure I had, exploring dry washes, little hills, things like that. I love that type of life. And to say I was addicted to it might be too strong, but to say I was fascinated by it, I think would be proper. And later on in life, years later, I was working in mortgage banking. I was a commercial loan officer, and I was bored out of my mind. I wanted adventure back in my life, like I had as a kid. And I ran into a friend of mine. He says, well, look, there's a gold mining company out of Phoenix, Arizona, and they're looking for some underwater divers. He says, why don't you talk to them? And I did, and to make a long story short, they hired me.
You'd never been
And
a diver,
so
right?
I'd
You'd never
never
been a
been a
diver.
diver before. I'd bluffed my way in, but I figured I could learn and they might teach me. And they really weren't getting too many guys looking for that type of work, so I think I had it made when I went in there. But we all went to Ecuador, and they had, oh, quite a manifest of equipment. They had a big Mack truck they were taking in. They had, do you remember during the World War II, the old Duck? It was an amphibious vehicle.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. They had one of these, and they had their suction dredges mounted on it. So they had all this heavy equipment. They shipped it down by boat into the port of Guayaquil. And of course, the rest of us flew down. And this started the great adventure for me. But when they got there, the Ecuadorian government hit them with a special tax, which was nothing more than what was called mordida back then. It was payoff to get all this equipment in. And they were proud people, and they said, no, we're not going to pay it. And so the government of Ecuador said, well, you can leave then. So they did. They went back to Arizona. I stayed. And that began, oh, a 9-year adventure down in the Republic of Ecuador.
Let's set the stage about Ecuador. Americans think about South America, they think about the Amazon, and they think about Brazil. Okay, that's the Amazon. Ecuador, man, Ecuador really is an unknown. It's a great big question mark, and it is incredibly inhospitable. Set the stage.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ecuador is positioned between, to the north is Colombia, to the south is Peru, to the west is the Pacific Ocean, or ocean there, and to the east is the Amazon jungle, the Amazon basin. It's a beautiful country. I mean, they have everything. They raise bananas there. Bananas is one of their big cash crops. But when I arrived in the 60s, half the country at that point had been unexplored, especially in what they call the Oriente region. And Oriente means in Spanish east. So the further you go east in Ecuador, the more you get into the jungle and what is called the Amazon. But it's a beautiful country. And after the mining company left, I went up to Cuenca, Ecuador, which is in the highlands. It's about 8,000 feet elevation. And the reason I selected Cuenca is because it is the gateway into the Oriente. But it was an old colonial city, beautiful city. The only problem with Cuenca was the fact that there was no television there. There was no communication of any kind. If you wanted to make a phone call to the States, you had to go to the telegraph office and wait your line, or turn in line to get a booth. And then place your call and hope that you could get out. So the communication was really lacking. But the country itself was going through some trouble at that time. And I might add that Ecuador in the 60s was really the Wild West. I mean, it was truly, once you left the cities, you were in no man's land. Very little police authority out in the Oriente. Few military garrisons, that was it. So you're pretty much on your own once you left the city life.
You didn't really get into it in the book a whole lot, but I was just wondering if there were rebels. A Shining Path was running around in Peru, and other very Che Guevara in other parts of South America. Was that what it was? Commie or leftist rebels running around?
No, not at all. My entertainment at night, while I was waiting to put my expeditions together and everything, I had a choice between listening to Mozart on the BBC or listening to Havana Anna out of Cuba. And man, she was something else to listen to, I tell you. She had this sultry voice, but her topic of the evening was the American casualties. And she would read oh, serial numbers, ranks, things like that. Talking about the American forces that were killed by the patriotic Vietnamese artillery. That was going on. So that was really creating a lot of problems in the country. But we really didn't see it. I didn't see it at that time. It wasn't until I went back to in the 70s that I really saw what was happening with the excuse me, with the Cuba invasion of the airways going on, because you had Castro in Cuba, and a lot of these countries were in dire straits financially, and anyway, it was a rough time politically.
You had said you used the phrase Wild West, which is exactly what I was thinking. You're, you know, a Wild West in more ways than one. You have dangers of all sorts out in the jungle, but in the cities themselves, I mean, you're describing these places that are, you know, they I guess on the map they would look like cities and towns with modern conveniences, but even in what could pass as a city, there wasn't a heck of a lot. It sounded pretty rustic.
No,
the places
yeah.
where you stayed.
Oh, the areas that in Cuenca wasn't too bad. The only problem with Cuenca is there were no restaurants there. The only place you could eat was two hotels. And like I said, communication was terrible. But basically, the people were nice. But once you left Cuenca and the gateway to the Oriente, that became a whole different scenario. Because the area I had to fly into, for example, when I found out about the emeralds, the emerald story, and the last will and testament of the man that found the emeralds, was a jungle outpost called Sakua. And the only way you could get in was by either charter plane or a military DC-3. And they were losing planes at a rapid rate down there because of the weather problems and because of mechanical problems and other things. But basically, the cities, like Sakura, there was no hotel there. I had to stay in a place called the Pension. And the problem with the Pension was it was a tiny little place. Excuse me. There were cobwebs in the corner of the room, big cobwebs. And the restroom, if you wanted to use a restroom, you had to go 50 yards from the pension through a mango swamp to get to the toilet. And one time I was there, the manager of the hotel told me, he says, be careful when you go there. He said, we had a man bitten by a fertilance when he went in there. So needless to say, I didn't make too many trips in that direction.
We'll be going to a break here in about a minute. Talk to me in that time about the natural resources of Ecuador. I mean, you know, you hear treasure stories, that's one thing. But there is treasure there, natural treasures of all kinds. The resources are incredibly diverse and rich, correct?
Oh, correct. They have tremendous timber in the Oriente. They have lots of gold. And the major treasures, believe it or not, are Inca treasures. Because when the Spaniards came in to finally conquer the Incas in those last days, the Inca king sent out word by runners to hide the treasures. So there were a lot of Inca treasures in caves and things like this that people were searching for. But the natural treasures of timber, of gold, and precious gems were pretty much a known fact.
Well, Lee Elders, in your new book, Expeditions, Lee Elders tells us how he found some of that treasure. We'll get into that in just a moment and talk about this lost fortune in emeralds. We're talking with adventurer Lee Elders about his expeditions into the heart of darkness in tropical Ecuador. The book is called Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire. And unlike most treasure hunt stories, this one actually resulted in him finding some treasure. We'll get to that part of the tale right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Lee Elders, let's reset the scene. You're in your 20s. It's the mid-60s. You go down to Ecuador on an adventure. You're going to be a diver with a team that's going to, I guess, set up a dredging operation looking for gold out in the Ecuadorian jungles. The team gets there, and they're turned back because of a sort of a bribe request put on them by Ecuadorian officials, but you decide to stay. So How did you decide where you were going to go and what the next step was?
Well, I knew the general location of where the mining company had planned to go. So after I went up to Cuenca, set up my base of operations, I really rolled the dice at this point. I bought a pocket dictionary, Spanish. My Spanish wasn't that great. And I took off. I rented a Land Rover and took off. And I went into the area, and in doing so, I met some Cunari Indians who live in that area. And they agreed to work with me. And so we went out to pan this river. It was called the Rio Xingata. That was the target river from the mining company. We spent days on the river, and we got a little bit of color, but nothing really to write home about. And I kept hearing these Cunari boys talking about Pepas, and they thought I was crazy for being on this river and I should be looking for Pepas. And I checked my Spanish dictionary, and Pepas meant nuggets. So they really had my attention. So I said, "Okay, do you know of a river like that?" And they said, "Yes, we do." And they said, "But there's only one problem. If we take you in, will you share with us, and will you share with the village in Nambon?" And I said, "Of course, yeah, I'll be happy to, no problem." So that started the trek into a river called Little Hell. And it took 3 days to walk into and 3 days to walk out. It was a very long walk. And we couldn't carry more than, I'd say 5, 6, 7 days of food supplies. And I hired seven guys to go with me. And they had what was called batayas. Now, batea is a large round, it's sort of like our gold pan of the 1880s up in Alaska, where these miners would use a gold pan to wash gold with. Well, the batea was larger, had a deeper angle to it. And so anyway, we took off, we went in, we finally got to the river, and started washing gold along its banks. And they told me it was very prolific. And I thought, okay. But after about 2 hours of washing, we started pulling out gold nuggets, incredible, beautiful nuggets. The first one was found was about the size of my thumbnail. And the second one would look like a lens.
Contact lens.
Contact lens, yeah, thank you. And so this went on, and I thought, my God, this is incredible. And we filled, I think it was two coffee cans full of gold nuggets in about 6 hours of washing.
Wow.
And that was like five men washing. And eventually the washers would get cold, so we would substitute. We would take turns. And what I thought was a walk in the park after about 30 minutes in that cold water, your mind goes numb and you just have to shut it out of your mind. It's very, very demoralizing, shall I say. But we hung in there. We washed out two coffee cans of gold. That night, I thought, man, we'll get an early start tomorrow, and this is going to be great. During the night, a storm came in from the mountains. We were up in the highlands there. All of a sudden, we had a lot of rain. Next morning, we got up. We were cut off. We had put our camp on the opposite side of the river because it was the high area. And here we were, cut off. We couldn't get back across the river. The river's overflowing. We couldn't get back to Nambon or back to civilization. So for about 3 or 4 days there, we waited and waited for the water to go down. Never did go down. But luckily, we had found, through a mysterious dog that had joined us on the trail, nobody knew who he was, but he became our friend. And he had left us, and we thought, well, he's gone. We'll never see him again. And then we heard him barking. And we went upriver, and he was barking at this log that had wedged itself in the river and would allow us to cross the river to get out of there, because we had at that point Quenlings, food supplies, all of that. So we knew we had to get out. But anyway, I got the coffee cans out with the gold, and we finally made it back to civilization. And it was quite an adventure. It was my first success.
Well, yeah, let's not skip over the fact that you said, well, we went in. But going in is no skip in the park. I mean, it was a really arduous journey there, right, just to get there.
It really was. We were in the highlands, and it was thin air. It was cold. It was very, very cold. The wind was always blowing. That was for 2 days. And the third day, we finally hit the jungle, and we had to cut through and chop through the jungle into what the Indians, what the Kanyaris told me were tubes. So here we are cutting little round tubes to go through the jungle, and it was great for them because they're all about 5 foot two. But for myself, it wasn't very comfortable. But anyway, we finally got there. But it was an arduous journey, and a lot of cramping, a lot of soreness in the legs. But, I mean, it was difficult, but it wasn't even close to what I would get into later when I was searching for the emeralds.
So you're there. You start finding gold pretty much immediately. I mean, you're tired from a three-day journey through this wilderness, but you get to the site, and you kind of get gold fever and are jazzed about the prospect of finding some nuggets, and boom, you start finding them right off the bat.
Oh, it was gold fever plus. I mean, we were revved up. And the thing about the Indians that were with me, they told me that they could never get to this river. And I couldn't understand why. And they told me, well, they said, we don't have the money to buy picks or shovels or batayas or sleeping bags or anything like that. And it's a 6-day journey. And all we can do is on our back, we can take food for maybe 7 days. So we chop for three days, travel, pan for 1 day, and then come home. And that was it. So they were very excited because we did have one tent with us, but it was a grueling journey to get there, but we were excited, and we got there about noon, I would say, and we didn't want to waste any time. We started panning right away, started washing.
When you started finding gold right off the bat, I know from the book that you started recalculating, okay, we only have enough food, supplies, whatever, to stay here a couple of days. If we start stretching it out, we could make it last a couple more days, and that'd be add to our fortune, right? So your plans were to stay longer than you ended up staying.
Absolutely, and if it hadn't rained that night, now the Indians blamed it on the mountain spirits, of course, and they said that the mountain spirits would check anybody going in there, and your heart had to be in the right place. Well, apparently they were disillusioned with one of us or all of us, and we had the most incredible thunderstorm that night, and it just soaked everything. And the next day, when we couldn't cross back, we started really rationing our food. We didn't know how long we would be there. And finally, after about 4 days, 5 days, we were really getting down on our food. When we left, I think we had three or four bags of freeze-dried applesauce. We had crackers, things like that. That was about all we had left, and some beef jerky. And so we had to make it work for us to keep up our strength to get out of there for a 3-day walk back to civilization.
I don't know what your sensitivities are to these stories about spirits at that part, at that point of your life, but I know that your views on that, what they became afterward. There you are, you're on this tough journey through this jungle and through this mountainous region. Along the way, a mystery dog sort of joins you. If not for that dog, I mean, you could have really been stuck. If he hadn't found that tree that had fallen across the river, not sure how you would have got out of there.
Well, he reminded me a lot of my coyote that I had. And I might add that the coyote left the house where we were living and everything. I had to go spend the weekend with my mother in Globe, Arizona. And when I came back, he was gone. My grandfather said that He had howled constantly after I left. And then finally he took off. I never saw him again. And I felt that probably he may have rejoined his pack. Maybe he felt I abandoned him. I don't know. But it was a terrible time in my life as a youngster to know that he left like that. And then this dog appears on the trail, and he's yellowish in color, about the same size. I remember the morning when I got out of the tent and we were having breakfast, and I noticed something different in the camp. And I asked Carlos, I said, "What's going on?" And he pointed over in the corner, and there was this dog sitting over there, and he was keeping his distance from the men. And I asked him, I said, "Where'd he come from?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, okay, he's with us. Let's name him." So I named him Perro. And Perro in Spanish means dog, so that was easy. But anyway, Perro became my tent mate after a while. First, he wouldn't come near me. I had to get down on the ground on my knees, hold the food out, and become of equal size to him before he would trust me. And later on, we built up the trust between us, and he would sleep in the tent and so forth. But here's this strange dog, which really saves our butts back there, because he finds this log that we can cross. And on the way back, I might add, I think it was the second day on the journey back, Perro disappeared. And I asked the Indians, I said, "Well, have you seen Perro?" And they said, "No." And Carlos, he said, "Well," he said, "he may have, you know, went back to his den." So I saw him for that brief period of time. He saved us on getting out, and then he disappears on the trail back. So it really started me thinking about when they told me about the spirits in the mountains. And I'm thinking about the spirit dog that the Indian medicine man told me about. He says, "Your dog is a spirit dog. He'll always be there to help you." It made me wonder, was Perro Lobo, my coyote friend? So it was a nice story. It was a nice thought. But
you get back to civilization, or what passed for civilization, with couple of piles of gold. I can't imagine what the value would be today, but you must have done the mental calculations yourself.
Oh yeah, well, back then in the 60s it was $35 an ounce. Today it's what, 1600 an ounce, something like that. So no, I wasn't a rich man, because I did share with those that went in with me, my workers, and we shared some with the village. But it was a nice poke. And at that point in time, when we got to Guayaquil, I called a friend of mine down in Yuma, Arizona, Bob Olson, who was a big builder down there, contractor, good friend of mine. And I asked Bob if he wanted to join me in Ecuador and help me build a dredge to get to this gold property. So he flew down. He came down, and it took us months to build the dredge, to find all the parts. So we returned, I made a journey to return to Little Hell with the dredge, but a strange thing happened. I had met this young man in Cuenca who today is a great friend of mine. He's a doctor of law and international law in Ecuador. But Adriano Ventimiglia, when I met him, I needed a translator and some help. And he volunteered. He was going to college at the time. But he also worked at the Court of Justice in Cuenca. And he said, "Look," he says, "I'll help you, but I do insist that we check out anybody that you hire." Now, how they check them out is beyond me, because the lack of communication and the lack of many things down there. But he had this way of doing it. And he ran a check on all the cargo carriers that we had hired to take the dredge in, gasoline, things of this nature. He found out that three of the men we had hired had criminal records. One was a horse thief, and the other two had been involved in some murders. So he says, you've got to fire these guys, get rid of them. So I remember the day that we arrived in Nabon. We had, well, I guess maybe 150, 200 people just stampeding around, everybody wanting to be hired by us to carry cargo. I mean, they were very impoverished there, and they needed work real bad. And I remember we had hired maybe 65 to hire all the heavy stuff. And three of these men were hired. But now we had to fire them. We had to get rid of them. And I knew that that might create a problem. Well, it certainly did. After they were fired, apparently they vowed between themselves to get even with us. And one of them penetrated back into our workforce. And on the second day when we were camped near this lagoon, which was really an extinct volcano area, this man had taken our drinking water that night while we were asleep and refilled, thrown it out, and refilled our drinking water with tainted water from the lagoon that had sulfur in it. Well, the next day, we all came down sick, everybody except me and a few other guys. And Bob was deathly ill, Bob Olson. And here we are in this valley of darkness, I call it, valley of depression, near an old extinct volcano. And we've just come down this ridge. I don't know how tall it was, how high it was, but we had to follow a game trail down. It was very muddy. And it took all of our strength to get there. And now all of a sudden I'm faced with the choice of going out the same way we just came in with one man to try to get horses up on the ridge to get all of our sick workers out. So I did this. It took, I think the journey that day and night took 16 hours. And it was the most arduous journey I've ever had in my life. I journeyed with a young boy named Washington, who we had hired. And he and I walked out, finally got to Nabon, and finally got the horses to get back to the ridge in order to get the men up the ridge and on horseback and bring them out. But anyway, the second expedition to hell was canceled. And I felt I'd been betrayed. Not only had these men betrayed me, they'd betrayed the village and all the workers there.
Well, before you go on with that, I want to back up. That first trip you took, you come out with gold. Don't know what it would be worth now, but it would be worth a heck of a lot more than it was then. You did the right thing. You shared it with the natives. I think they must have been surprised that a white man didn't exploit them and steal it from them. That sort of laid the groundwork for trust that developed later that was very important to you.
Oh, it really was, because the day we arrived to begin the second expedition to Little Hell, the Catholic priest in the area came to us, and he really thanked me for what I had done. So word had spread fast that I had shared not only with some of the villagers, but with the workers. And he sort of blessed our journey, and he helped us arrange everything for the second trip, which wound up not being taken because of the betrayal of this one man and what he did to our drinking water.
Your vision was, though, that, oh my gosh, I found all this gold in this river. We can only imagine what we could find if we had a bigger operation and dredging equipment, things of that sort. And then you got wind later about the lost fortune in emeralds. And when we come back, we'll pick up the story there. Moby Grape, and I know some of those Moby Grape members listen to the program. Moby Grape takes us into the break here with a song called Hey Grandma. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.